Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about the events that take place from 1949 through to the mid-1950s in China, and specifically Mao Zedong's relationship with the Chinese peasantry and the way in which that relationship changes, how he attempts to build a power base in the countryside, and the savage violence that really stems from that. I've been reading recently, for anyone that wants to kind of immerse themselves in this topic, Frank Decota's The Tragedy of Liberation. I've mentioned before Frank Decota's Mao's Great Famine. This is the book that comes before it, that is a fantastic read. And it's a fantastic read, really, because it's a great piece of scholarship. Very few Western scholars are capable of really fathoming the rural archives that are dotted across China. But Frank Decota has been able to do that and really bring to light an entirely different picture of Maoist China. The decline in popularity of Stalinism in the West by the 1950s amongst Western fellow travellers, particularly after Stalin's death and then following the suppression of the Budapest uprising, meant that Western intellectuals who had sympathies towards communism needed to look elsewhere. And Maoism tended to attract in the 50s, 60s and 70s a far less critical microscopic analysis than Stalinism had. And therefore, the view emerged until really the events of the Cultural Revolution became too significant to ignore, that Maoism was in some way far more benign. The period of time from 1949 through to the Great Leap Forward, when that's properly analysed, really dispels that notion. And that's really the subject of what I want to talk about today. Mao comes to power in 1949. The Chinese communists win the civil war, not out of a massive upsurge in popularity for the Chinese Communist Party, but really because of a sense of overwhelming exhaustion. The Kuomintang nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek obviously have both their supporters and their detractors, but by and large, they have far wider popular legitimacy among much of the nation, both in the towns and cities in China, but particularly amongst the peasants, than the communists do. Much of what the communists argue is kind of lost on the peasantry, who have a far more traditionalist and conservative, with a small c, way of looking at things, and loyalties towards Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists. The civil war that rages from 1945 to 1949 is as traumatic, if not more so, across China than the war with Japan. And by 1949, the country has experienced 12 years of conflict. And as the communists gain the upper hand, partly because Truman starts to really get cold feet about supporting Chiang Kai-shek, and Stalin continues in his support for Mao, many cities across China simply hope that the fighting can end and the cities can actually fall to the communists without too much bloodshed. The communists, therefore, when they seize cities like Nanjing or Chongqing or Shanghai, are an unknown quantity. Ordinary Chinese hope for the best. Some of them prepare for the worst. But nobody really quite understands ideologically what Mao intends. And there's a good reason for that, is that Mao has been incredibly cagey between 1945 and 1949. With what he plans to do. So he doesn't want to alarm the middle classes. He certainly talks generally of a kind of a democratic state of affairs where the Communist Party might rule, but a broad coalition of social democratic parties will be accepted, obviously not including the Kuomintang nationalists. And the large Chinese industrialists and entrepreneurs are reassured that they will not be under threat, their property will not be confiscated, there may be higher taxes, but Mao is at pains to present his moderateness, his moderation, his moderate side. He is at pains to also present this moderate sense of himself to the outside world and project a kind of a facade of being a national as opposed to a kind of like an ideological leader. In order to enact massive social change in China, to bring about modernization and modernity through a complete break with the past and a complete revolution in China's social structure, Mao needs to build himself a support base. The supporters that he's had up to now have been the guerrilla armies that have fought with him. These are observed by ordinary Chinese civilians when they march into the towns and cities at the end of the Civil War as being kind of very, very quiet, very serious men, normally men, some women, but normally men, who are enormously dedicated to Mao, to the revolution. Some are viewed as being, quite kind of respectable and polite, and there is very little of the looting and violence that's gone along with the war. But the cadres and the soldiers who occupy China's cities are there really to bring about revolutionary change. But Mao is lacking the kind of the national widespread support base, and so he starts to build it in the countryside. Now, here is the point at which the lie that Mao's transition to communism was a peaceful one is given. Mao believed, or he argued, that a class system of oppression in the countryside existed, and that the communists were there really to end all that. He wanted to redistribute the land from what he called landowners to the peasants. Now, Frank Decota's great kind of gift to us, his great piece of scholarship, is the evidence that the term landowner or landlord in China didn't exist. It was a Japanese notion that had been imported. The structure of land ownership across China, because China's such a huge country and varies geographically from, deserts to the subtropics, the structures of land ownership are immensely complex. But as the Tragedy of Liberation points out, really quite egalitarian. There is an awful lot of evidence that the peasants were quite capable of sharing land in a notionally fair way. The idea that there were there was a kind of a structure of land ownership, rather like in Russia, of landowners and serfs prior to 1861, it doesn't seem to exist in China at all. It only exists after Mao introduces it. Mao, however, brings about the village tribunals where wealthier peasants are dragged in front of the rest of the village to be denounced, to be criticised, to be harangued, often wearing conical paper dunce caps, in the initial stages. There's some violence against them. Within a year or two, most of the people who are taken before the village are brutally murdered in really not kind of systematized state violence, but very much kind of angry mob violence. And Mao, this is how Mao spread violence to the countryside. And it was a tried and tested technique used by Lenin. When Lenin, during the Russian Civil War, didn't really have the military power to attack the middle classes himself, he simply used propaganda and inspired angry mobs and vigilante action to do it. The first instance of violence in the countryside that Mao witnessed as a young man and terribly impressed him, he saw in 1921 during post-revolutionary chaos under the warlords in China. And he saw a Soviet-inspired war against what we could call landowners, but really landlords, but really wealthy peasants in the countryside. And he thought this was excellent. He thought this was a fantastic thing because what he believed he was seeing was the old order, the old regime being torn down. And something new replacing it that was going to revolutionise life for the peasantry in the countryside. The involvement of the Soviet Union in the attitudes towards the peasantry in China is very important in understanding everything that's going on here. By 1924, the Soviet Union are chiefly involved in operations in China. Firstly, supporting the Communist Party, then maybe looking towards the nationalists as being the force that can kind of consolidate China against the real threat of Japan. The post-war, post-Second World War involvement of Stalin in China was really Stalin's advice to Mao that given the anti-peasant, anti-Kulak campaigns in the Soviet Union and the actual real legacy of that, the famines and the economic chaos that those caused, he actually suggests to Mao that really it's not worth attacking China's peasantry in quite the same way and that there is there's little to be gained from it. What Mao believes can be gained from it is the development of a peasant communism. And one of the suspicions that Stalin always has of Maoist China is that the deviation away from focusing on the urban working class as the revolutionary vanguard to looking towards the peasantry is a real kind of deviation from Marxism and something really quite dangerous and subversive. Initially, what Mao is attempting to achieve in the countryside is not the kind of collectivisation and modernisation, in inverted commas, that Stalin hoped to create during the period of collectivisation and the five-year plans. Stalin's Mao's great leap forward that happens in the later 1950s and early 1960s is equivalent to Stalin's kind of five-year plan moment. Initially, Mao is looking to do something far more cynical, far more base, if you will, by whipping up resentments and hatreds within the countryside, he knows he can develop a support base for himself. By simply introducing the ideas into villages, which have been largely harmonious for many, many decades, even centuries, that certain people are exploiters. The explosion of angers and hatreds does an awful lot to bolster party support in those areas. Some people within the villages really know that they are involved. They are expected to respond in certain ways. There is a sense that the new government desires some kind of ritual to happen within particular villages, and the villagers very quickly learn their parts as denouncers, as accusers. And there's an awful lot of looting at the end when the hapless peasant is murdered along with his family. And the looting, in a way, incriminates the entire village and places them firmly within the purview of the state. They are kind of co-conspirators with the state in a murder within the village. And the point is, of course, in these tiny, tight-knit rural communities within China, everybody knows everyone else's business and everyone knows what's really gone on. So it has the perverse effect of really cementing the party into that local area through a kind of a collective guilt. One thing that tends to happen as well is that there is a cycle of retribution. The People's Liberation Army clearly don't have a monopoly on violence within rural China. So when a family is denounced and destroyed within the village, distant relatives or close relatives very often come back armed to the teeth and make their own private war on the people that have denounced their family. The fear that the village then has against these kinds of guerrilla attacks forces it into the hands of the state yet further. There's an account by Deng Xiaoping saying that the village asked us to kill off some people that they viewed as being class enemies. We did so, and then their family came back and attacked the village, so the village asked us to kill those people too, and we did so. And then their relatives came back, and the village asked us to kill them, and eventually we had to kill hundreds and hundreds of people. And so the state involves itself and kind of inspires this cycle of escalation. Statistics on how many people in these initial phases of rural tribunals, purges, and executions were killed are difficult to gauge. Frank de Coe thinks probably a million in the first couple of years of Mao's takeover in China. And when you compare that to the numbers of deaths under Mao's famine in the late 1950s, early 1960s, which conservatively are estimated at 40 million, it gives you an idea of the kind of the scope of the destructiveness of Maoism. I was reading in Dominic Sunbrook's Seasons in the Sun, his History of Britain 74 to 79, the cabinet meeting that followed the death of Chairman Mao, where Tony Benn was indignant that the British cabinet, who were fighting off a currency crisis at the time, were not wearing sackcloth and ashes over the death of Chairman Mao, or in his eyes, one of the great statesmen of the 20th century. It's one of those stunning kind of aspects of Western political discourse, isn't it, that no cabinet minister would stand up and say, you know, why have we not celebrated, you know, the anniversary of Hitler's death? But it's quite possible for a British cabinet minister or Western intellectuals, very often who are very removed from the violence committed by the people that they cheer about, to commiserate the death of someone like Mao Zedong. A significant historical figure, I grant you, and yet one whose the destructiveness and the violence that Mao perpetrated on China really has yet to really kind of be fully acknowledged by his by Western audiences of either detractors or admirers. So I'll be reading some more of The Tragedy of Liberation, and we can talk about that in a later podcast. Now, it's exam season rapidly approaching, that glorious time of year again, so if you are facing your GCSEs or A-levels, check out the Explaining History YouTube channel. You can access it via our website or just look up Explaining History on YouTube, and I'm currently posting up there some useful exam stuff for the coming weeks and months. Always, if you're stuck on anything, if you've got a dilemma, or if you just need help with an exam question, drop me a line at info@explaininghistory.com, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Thanks. Bye-bye.